I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. This one is with a historian's historian about the election that we all sense is historic, yet we read it mainly in polls, personalities, and tactics, almost never in terms of the past that got us here or about the future that's unfolding. Journalists, including me, learn to see presidential campaigns as a sort of gang warfare. The gangs of New York playing capture the flag. So what does a real historian see? We're engaged here with Gordon Wood, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his book on the radicalism of the American Revolution, and who critiques the best of the modern crop of historians in his new book, The Purpose of the Past. In his office at Brown University, Gordon Wood began by saying, yes, historians will have the last word on what happened to our country in 2008, but it's going to take a while.
Historians know more than the people they write about, than the people themselves knew. Now, there are some things that the participants know that no historian will ever recover. The details of life and so on, the intimacies of life. But by and large, most historians know more. We know more about the American Revolution than the revolutionaries themselves. Historians of this election, whether it's 10 years from now or 100 years from now, will know more about its significance than we can ever possibly. We can guess, but I think it's impossible to predict.
This is such a fascinating point, and I'm glad you brought it up. The simple notion that the players on the field barely know what's going on. Someday it'll be seen in a perspective that makes some sense, and that's the historian's job.
Yeah, I think the financial crisis that's come upon us rather suddenly that seems to have amazed everybody, including Mr. Greenspan, some people probably predicted it, and they'll make much of that, but most people did not see it coming, did not understand the depth of it, simply don't understand the world we're living in. And that's perfectly understandable, because I think most people are caught up in forces over which they have very little control. And I think that sense comes out of historical study, where you look back and you see individuals struggling to make sense of a world that's moving much faster than the participants understood. I've noticed that both candidates began picking. Obama started with the notion of change. McCain picked it up, and they are going to be agents. Both of them have claimed to be agents of change. That's not going to be their problem. Their problem is not bringing about change. Their problem will be managing the change that's occurring all around them, that will occur all around them. Anybody who says that America needs agents of change is not really aware of just how things do happen. I think change is occurring right now and will occur, and I think the president's job will be to get a hold of that change and ride it in some way, manage it, not to bring it about.
But this is precisely why I want to talk to a historian, because, I mean, I think every citizen, I'm sure the candidates too, would love to imagine some sort of Rube Goldberg mirror out there by which they could anticipate what people are going to say about this moment that they understand so little, in a way. I want that historian's kind of guide to the longer lines, the trend lines, the underlying, you know, the fundamentals, as they say, about the economy, as to where we're going.
Well, I think that's hard, and that, in fact, the historical sense gives you breeds a sense of a tragic sense. I don't mean a pessimistic sense, but just a sense of the limitations of life, that one isn't always in control. And that I think all of these candidates will find that they've been carried along. And I think candidates generally do feel they're being carried along by forces that they scarcely can understand. Now, we're coming up to the 200th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's birth. And Lincoln, of all the presidents in our history, for good reason, because he confronted a civil war, had a deep tragic sense that he was scarcely in control of the events that carried him along. And I think that is a kind of wisdom that Lincoln had. Simply, he wasn't an educated man in the sense that he went to Princeton or Harvard, but he had self-educated himself and had a deep, brooding sense of the tragedy of life. And that made him the ideal president for such catastrophic event as the Civil War.
And what was the way out of his own understanding of a certain blindness in the moment?
Well, I think he just had a sense that life is very difficult, that one is limited in what you can do, and didn't paralyze him, but he always felt that things were hard to it was hard to make a decision that you could be completely confident in, because there were pressures bearing in on him, and as a consequence, I think he made the right decisions with that sense of the limitations of life. That's an important. It's what we mean by wisdom. It leads to it leads to humility. Let's put it that way. Something that I think our political leaders need. They should be more humble in the face of this complicated world, and cautious and prudent. All of those things, it seems to me, Lincoln had, and I think I think politicians need them. And I think Obama seems to be demonstrating that kind of temperament. That is to say, he is cautious, he is pragmatic, he seems prudent, and his temperament seems to be right, as people say, for the kind of world, dangerous world that we're in.
For me, one of the most interesting reflections of ourselves in a historical mirror, it turns on an old argument that the founders had about republics and empires. And I would love to think that 2008 is going to be a popular repudiation of a sort of lurch into the hubris and now nemesis of foreign domination, bullying people abroad. Does that make sense as a historical frame to see where we've come to and where we're maybe have to go?
Well, I think that Obama's, if he should be elected, the impact will be tremendous abroad. There'll be some awe, I think, at what the United States is. It'll be stunning, I think, the effect. Mm. And already, of course, he has this effect when he traveled abroad. He drew these huge crowds. I think this will be similar to the kinds of feelings people had about Kennedy, where he could draw huge crowds as well, only they'll be much greater for Obama. And there'll be an expectation that our foreign policy will change in some fundamental way. I don't think it will. There'll be a change of tone, I suppose, and certainly there'll be none of the hubris that you mentioned. But our involvement in the world will still be there, and I'm afraid that it's going to be just as much messy as it's been in the past. It's going to be very difficult for the next president to, and if it should be Obama, to change policy in any fundamental way. Now, we pull out of Iraq, but that's already in the cards in one date or another. But Afghanistan is still there, and the Iranian problem will be looming over the whole 4 years of the next president's administration. So I think Obama will have a psychological impact on the world that McCain would never have had. And I think that will have some kind of effect. But how long it will go, how deep it will be, well, we'll see. I don't think the United States will change its policies significantly enough, perhaps, to win over the world.
I wonder if that's a historian's judgment, that a new leadership with a new popular mandate can't change the fundamentals of a national situation.
It won't change the fundamentals, but it changed the tone. And he may close Guantanamo and these kinds of maybe superficial things will have a profound effect. But fundamentally, our interests in the Middle East, our interest in Israel, those will remain, and the president will have to deal with those. And the terror threat will continue, and God forbid that there should be a terror attack if Obama should get elected. That would be devastating to the Democrats, because it would seem as then the Republicans will pick that up and say, look, we kept you safe, and the Democrats couldn't do it. That's the kind of problem that new administration will face. So his surveillance, his intelligence surveillance, will have to be as strict as it was. It may not be as crude, but it'll have to be as strict as it was under Bush, I would think, unless he's out of his mind and brings on a, you know, by softening up, brings on another attack.
Let me put it another way, sort of a historian's question. Who's been here before? Who's been in this situation before? Is there an American cycle that's repeating itself? Or do you see parallels in world history? Everybody wants to know, are we Rome? There have been moments when I thought of Hadrian in Trajan's army, Roman time now. But Hadrian, a very tough general himself, realized that Rome was way overextended in Mesopotamia. He fought his way to the throne, and then he pulled back out of the east in a sort of reform administration of the empire early in the 2nd century AD. And I thought, you know, maybe that's the Hadrian's the guy we need. But the question for the historian is really, how do nations recover, or don't they, from this debilitating disease of foreign adventure?
Yeah. Well, I think we are probably overextended. I mean, we've got troops in, 40-some countries, and it's
700 bases or whatever.
It's very difficult to maintain that kind of especially when your finances are in disarray. But there's nobody really ready yet to take our place. I mean, the Chinese may at some distant date, but they're not ready now. And so there has to be some kind of world leadership, and we've got this thrust upon us. I think you won't find the kind of neocon hubris that we had under the Bush administration. I don't think there'll be an interventionist philosophy, but there will be a commitment to the world. I just don't see us pulling back. I think the world's too scary, but I hope it'll be done more subtly and more with greater finesse than we've had, and taking into account, of course, other nations' interests. But I don't think our national interests are going to be changed in any fundamental way. We're going to be in the Middle East, not just simply because of oil, but because of Israel. And we're not going to pull out in any fundamental way.
Can we be there more creatively, more...
Of course.
More, not just even-handedly, but more insistent on some resolution before the whole thing bleeds us to death or involves us in a much bigger conflict.
Well, if you're talking about a resolution of the Arab-Israeli problem, I wouldn't hold my breath. I don't see any solution in the foreseeable future. I can't imagine it happening. The interests are too solidified. There's just no way we'd have to force it, and that would not be possible. So I don't see the Arab-Israeli problem going away. I think it will remain and aggravate the Middle East for the foreseeable future, certainly for the rest of my lifetime. I'm pessimistic about that.
Hmm.
I would say realistic.
Gordon, Ralph Waldo Emerson said famously, there is properly no history, only biography. And in this case, 2008 campaign, we come down to two men with pretty serious and interesting lives. I wonder what you make of that general premise that the individuals here are driving it and that they will be the story in the long run.
Well, I'm not that kind of historian. I certainly don't agree with Emerson. I think that the circumstances are far more important than the biographies, although I wouldn't discount. I think it was a miracle that we had someone like Lincoln at the time of the Civil War. And perhaps leadership becomes important. People are driven to, by circumstances, to rise above themselves. Harry Truman seems to have been a case in point, although his popularity at the time is second administration, the end of his administration, was almost as low as, or was as low as George Bush's. So, but I think circumstances are far more important than the individual, and that. It's the circumstances that are going to circumscribe the ability of anybody, whether it's Bush or whether it's McCain or Obama, to rise above and transform the world. He will have a transformative effect, I think, simply because he's black or is seen as black. He'll change race relations, not as fundamentally as some may hope, but certainly will change things. And he'll change the image of the United States. We've always awed the Europeans or the rest of the world. Lincoln was they couldn't believe it that someone as poor and as uneducated should become president. I think that this will be a similar kind of, they'll say, what a country. It is an extraordinary thing when you think about it, of this kind of diversity. And the nation will, I think, reap tremendous benefits internationally for a honeymoon period until the realities kick in and our interests are still around doing things, because no president can control the vast bureaucracy. There are going to be mistakes made. There are going to be army killings. There are going to be all kinds of bombings that take place that we shouldn't have bombed in Pakistan or wherever, regardless of who's president, because he can't be there issuing directives to everybody unless he calls for a massive pullout of every place. But I don't see that happening.
You keep emphasizing disappointment, which...
Because the expectations are so high.
Yeah, and it's a good caution, I suppose. But at the same time, what do you make of, again, from a historian's eye, the Obama phenomenon itself, this viral quality of his charm and his growth? Three of my kids wrote it down. We just found the index card, April 2007, a year and a half ago, that Barack Obama would be the next president, long before I was convinced it was possible. And here he is, among other things. He's run the most expensive presidential campaign, but maybe the least bought because of his mastery of the new technology, the digital technology of doing everything.
Right.
What do we make of that?
Well, I think one thing you can say is that the man has shown a tremendous executive ability in running a campaign. People say, well, he's never run anything except his campaign, but that campaign has been unbelievably efficient and successful venture, and it's a multi-million-dollar operation. So to say he's never run anything is a mistake. He's run something that most candidates for the presidency have never run, such a big, massive campaign for such a long period of time and so successfully with foresight. But I think the excitement comes for young people who, first of all, want the race problem ended. It is by far our most serious domestic problem. And if this can be a beginning or some kind of step towards the elimination of the race problem, I think most young people are just excited about that, in addition to his youthful appearance and of course, his coolness. I mean, he's got a kind of temperament that I think is ideally suited for the time, and I think that's very attractive. But I have no doubt that it's his the fact that he's black is appealing to lots of young people who look at the United States and see a continuation of a race problem. It's not going to be eliminated by his victory, but I think it will be eased in a certain way and will be over a hump, a kind of hump that I just don't think would have been possible. At least I wouldn't have expected it in 1950s when I was coming of age. I wouldn't have thought that a black person would get elected in my lifetime. But I'm being proved wrong, and my kids are the same way. They're terribly excited about Obama.
Gordon Wood, what does a historian make of the religious revival, the presence of the evangelicals in 2008 politics?
Well, I think it's a lot weaker than it was. It really, the revival really began in the 1970s, and I think right now
Jimmy Carter time.
Yeah, I think it's gone. It's receded to some extent. It certainly McCain made an attempt to appeal to it, and maybe they had importance in Huckabee's campaign. But it seems to me that they've receded in importance. The leadership seems to be in disarray, and there may be a growing return to the apolitical attitude that many evangelicals had, I think, prior to the 1970s. But one never knows. But I don't think religion is as important as it has been over the last 25 years or so, or will be as important in this election.
Cast it over the centuries.
Well, we've always had ups and downs in the early republic, in the period from 1800, 1840 or so. We had the so-called Second Great Awakening, where religion became very, very powerful and affected the culture. Baptists and Methodists came out of nowhere and had an emotional appeal to people that the old-fashioned religions, the Presbyterians and the Puritan religions, the Anglicans, couldn't handle and didn't have anything to offer people. And those Methodists, for example, there were no Methodists in America in 1760, and by the early 19th century, they were the largest denomination in the country in a matter of 30 or 40 years. That's an extraordinary development. And it's because the older religions simply couldn't meet the needs, the emotional needs of people. And I suppose that's still true. Those emotional needs are being met by Pentecostal religions and various staid people, conservative people, these kinds of crazy denominations, crazy sects that come out of nowhere, but are reaching tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people and meeting their emotional needs that more traditional religions have been unable to do.
So what is the Sarah Palin frenzy while it lasted?
I think that...
Where does that fit?
I think there's a certain class dimension in that she represents, and the Republican Party's been playing on that resentment ever since Nixon, I suppose. And it still carries a lot of weight. It's kind of ironic because the Democrats see themselves as the party of the common man, where in fact the common man has been voting for Republicans for a good number of years, partly because the liberal elites are resented by people like Palin and the people she represents. But this is nothing new in American politics. It goes back to the early Republic. You had politicians beginning to run against people who had gone to Harvard or Yale or Princeton and using that against them, to the point where many politicians hid their credentials. If they had been to Columbia, they played it down and emphasized that they were just common folk like the rest. That kind of class politics, egalitarian politics, populist politics, is as American as apple pie, and it's been a part of our politics from the very beginning.
Gordon Wood, you're a founding fathers kind of guy. What would they be saying about John McCain and Barack Obama fighting for leadership of their country in 2008?
Well, those are difficult questions to answer, but I think they would be...
Take them one by one. Madison, Jefferson,
Adam. Well, they would be... Madison and Jefferson, Southern slaveholding aristocrats would be stunned to realize that a black man, although not the son of a slave, nonetheless black and married to a black woman, would become president of the United States. I think it would be beyond their ken. And so in that sense, they were... But Hamilton and the Northerners, Jay, and others who were anti-slave, who were opposed to slavery, would, I think, be pleased that this is a justification of American egalitarianism, that anybody can rise. So they would have divided on this. I think in some fundamental sense, even Jefferson might have said, well, maybe my faith in the equality of America, despite my misgivings about race, has been fulfilled, that America is capable of having this kind of development. A man coming out of nowhere, so to speak, would be a justification of their dream, which was a Republican dream, small r, that merit would count and that the best would come to the top in a way that couldn't happen in a hereditary monarchy. So I think in some fundamental sense, maybe they all would, once you got over the race problem that especially the Southerners had, that they would be pleased that their country had fulfilled itself in this way.
I wonder if the Republicans, lowercase r, would also be saying, holy mackerel, but how did you become this prodigiously rich consumer society and the leader of a world economy, a world empire?
Well, I think they had dreams of America becoming important. Certainly Hamilton did. He wanted us to become the greatest state the world had ever known and the largest empire the world had ever known, the richest. And I think in that sense, his dreams have been fulfilled. Jefferson wanted a much more agrarian society, but he also wanted us to be important and to spread democracy throughout the world. So we are the heirs of their dreams, and we've been in various ways trying to fulfill those dreams, including spreading democracy throughout the world. Not necessarily by the use of troops, But certainly Woodrow Wilson echoed that dream, and it continues to this day. There's still, despite the disaster in Iraq, I think there's still a feeling that we stand for something and that the world would be better off if it were all democratic. Not necessarily just like us, but democratic. And I think that's a dream even the Europeans have bought into. And the EU has succeeded in democratizing various states that weren't democratic, Spain and Portugal, for example, or Greece. So I think the dream of democratizing the world was the founder's dream, and it's still very much a part of our consciousness.
Can I give away our secret that I had the great privilege of reading Tolstoy's War and Peace with you in a group this past summer, and we mused week after week about Napoleon in Russia and the interaction of men and movements in history, the transformation of continents and cultures, which Tolstoy found was in the end an irrational and unreadable process. But let's imagine what Tolstoy would make of what's happening in America today. How would he try to dope out the larger dimensions of what's stirring up this country?
He would take the line I'm taking and be very pessimistic about any individual changing things. Of course, he had a very deterministic view of the historical process, but far more deterministic than my own. But I think he's more right than wrong when he looks at the past and the way he plays down the importance of great heroes and looks at what the masses are doing. They have a very powerful effect. And Obama, for all of his brilliance and all of his superb campaigning, couldn't have achieved what he've achieved if hundreds of thousands, if millions of people hadn't changed their minds about race over the last half century. And I think that structural change that's taken place, and as I say, sports have been very influential, the military, the whole culture has changed. You know, Bill Cosby was the most popular show on television for a long time. That was a big deal.
Yeah.
And I think Obama's reaping the rewards of that transformation, but we've got a long way to go. And we don't want to get to believe that, well, once he's elected, our race problems are going to disappear.
Tolstoy was fascinated with this 15-year sweep of Western Europe to the east into Russia, and then the east sort of spitting it back out in these great big tides in the world. What would Tolstoy see about us and the wider world?
Well, I think he might take the view that we've been full of hubris, too proud, too arrogant, too believing that we were capable of doing whatever we wanted to do. I think he would take that kind of line, that the United States was acting in an arrogant fashion, Napoleonic-like, in it, if you will, and that we've had our comeuppance, that we aren't in control of the world, and we're not going to be able to control the world the way we thought we could when we went into Iraq. I mean, the naivete, the innocence of America, in a sense, was being exposed over the last decade. And maybe we're always losing our innocence, it seems, if it go back to the 1890s or earlier, and then World War I and World War II and Vietnam. We don't seem to be able to shake our own innocence. We are just as blundering internationally as we were in Vietnam. And what we need is just a little more caution, a little more prudence. Not that we haven't done great things internationally. World War II, I think, is our most successful venture. And the aftermath of that was truly a generous moment in American history with the Marshall Plan. And overall, the United States has played a significant role in the world over the last 60 years. But I don't think our intervention in Iraq was a wise move. We've been hurt by that, and I think we're going to find it difficult to deal with the aftermath.
Yeah, Tolstoy would also remind you that France somehow mysteriously survived.
Well, that's true, but it survived not. Well, it did. Obviously, you don't roll back history. You won't go back to something prior to what you've had. You'll have to absorb the And that will be true of this presidency as well. The Iraq is still there. We're going to be involved in it. Mm. Even if we pull our troops out, we're going to be involved in the Middle East. So we're not going to be able to escape from history, from what we've done, any more than France could escape from its Napoleonic era.
Will we say someday that this election closed the Reagan era, as your colleague Sean Wilentz closed this 30-year period since late Carter to now, roughly 1978 to 2008?
Well, it depends on what happens, of course. And Obama, if he should be elected, will not have as much freedom as he would like, and maybe as people expect. I think the economy will press in on him and limit his ability. I mean, the expectations are so high that he's bound to disappoint. They're just unbelievable expectations.
You seem to be betting on the notion, though, that time will reveal that race is the thread, and it turned. It became something significant happened to that story.
Well, I don't know. It may not. It may be that it turned out something else, something international will happen under, if Obama should win, under his administration, that would completely change the story. He becomes a different kind of president simply because events force him to become a different kind of president. I don't think we can predict that. But I would think at this point we can say that it looks as if race will be the important consequence. Race relations will be the important consequence of his election. Unless he should come in and destroy the economy in some fundamental way, then I think that's what his legacy will be. But we can't tell. We cannot predict. Historians are no better than anyone else in predicting the future.
It's a pleasure to hear you guess about it, Gordon Wood. Thank you enormously for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation with Gordon Wood. You're invited, please, to comment on our website about the era that is ending, or what we should call the new one, at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining the conversation.